This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Senator Tom Tillis quickly rose from a member of the Parks and Recreation Commission in Cornelius, North Carolina, to Speaker of the North Carolina House in 2011. He was chosen to lead that chamber when Republicans took control of the General Assembly for the first time since the Reconstruction era. And last year, he won a seat in the U.S. Senate. He's been in Washington for just 5 months, but he's made it clear that he supports a robust national security policy. He opposes the Obama administration's stand on immigration, and he wants to push for deregulation on a large scale. Senator Tom Tillis is the junior senator from North Carolina. He's a Republican, and he joins me now on the State of Things. Senator Tillis, thank you for joining us. Good day.
Glad to be here.
Senate just passed the USA Freedom Act, which allows bulk collection of American metadata. And you and North Carolina Senior Senator Richard Burr voted against that. Why'd you vote no?
Well, we were trying to, first, I supported the reauthorization of the underlying legislation. And I think that the House tried to make some progress towards providing a tool. But I think some of the mechanics and the time frame to make the transition from the information being held by the federal government now back into the hands of more than 1,000 different telecommunications companies is problematic. And for those reasons, we decided to vote against it. I may have taken a different position if we'd been successful with a few of the amendments.
You know, I mean, just on the big question of who collects the bulk data and control over that, obviously, the appeals court said last month the NSA was illegally using the Patriot Act to justify that collection of phone data. So how would you have allowed for the Patriot Act to stand, you know, with oversight? How do you make that adjustment in the fact of, you know, in light of that abuse?
Well, I spoke with officials in the Justice Department. They felt like that ultimately that decision of the lower court may have not withstood constitutional scrutiny. So we would have had to have gone through that process. But the concern that I have, well, first, since Snowden, the effectiveness of this program over time will diminish greatly, because now that we've provided for all the world to see a technique that was being used to track potential terrorist threats, we'll have to look at other ones. We'll have to deal with encryption issues, a number of other things that are coming down the pike. But my main concern is how we're going to be able to control. I think that there may be some potential for abuses, maybe more now, because of the dispersed nature of this information. It's going to be over hundreds of platforms, accessed by hundreds of people within those telecommunications organizations, and arguably on platforms that were not as secure as the NSA platform. So those are the kinds of mechanics that now we have to accept that this has been signed by the president, and we'll just have to make it work.
Let's talk about the defense budget. The Senate is now considering a $612 billion defense budget, and obviously a big, complicated piece of legislation. I'd like to focus on just one aspect of it. The Obama administration asked for $51 billion for overseas operations, and the Republican-led House increased that amount by nearly 75%. That's led to a Democratic filibuster in the Senate. You support the higher figure. Why?
Well, if you take a look at the increase in spending, the world has changed. ISIS has come onto the scene. We've got a number of other threats. Russia's in Crimea. We have threats in Western Europe. We have increasing threats in the Middle East. We have what I think is arguably a need to increase the amount of resources we're putting to Iraq to try and keep ISIS in check and ultimately expel them from Iraq. So there's a number of structural reasons why the number of threats we were dealing with a few years ago and today are very different. We've heard chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the new Secretary of Defense say the threat level now is greater than any time since 9/11. So to me, there's a logical basis for increasing spending. What we're also trying to do is take some of the edge off of the catastrophe we call sequestration, something that was passed, something that everybody said was so bad would never occur. Now it's commonplace. We ultimately have to repeal it. And the opposition that that Senator Reid has really is founded on his belief that we should repeal sequestration. The problem is we're talking about plussing up not only defense spending, but spending for the EPA or the IRS. I don't think that our defense spending should be on par with these other agencies that, when you remove sequestration, could arguably be cut, not necessarily plussed up.
Yeah, the fear is, too, is particularly in this area, in this arena, that, again, procedurally, you know how bureaucracy works. If you give me that budget, I better spend it or I'm not getting it next year. So that means this money's going to be spent. And the fear is that when you're talking about overseas operations, That may not be wise to put that much of an incentive with the Defense Department to spend the money when, in fact, if our national security is in jeopardy, we can come back to Congress, and if everybody figures this is it, you're going to get the money.
Well, Frank, one thing that we should keep in mind, the way that we are going about providing this increased funding will also be able to be used for training and readiness for ultimate use in these in the theaters overseas. So this is to try and take the edge off of diminishing funds available for training and readiness. I was at Fort Bragg and Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point over the last month, and they're concerned that if another phase of sequestration kicks in, it will truly begin to erode their readiness, and that means that it puts men and women in uniform deployed in forward positions at risk. So the emphasis behind plussing up the OCO funding was to make sure that we're getting the capabilities and the readiness on this side of the equation, not necessarily just funding what has been traditionally what you use OCO for. And make no mistake about it, it's not the best of all worlds. It's just the way that we can get money to areas that we think have suffered under sequestration.
And OCO is that overseas spending that we're talking about in the defense budget. Speaking of Fort Bragg, you introduced an amendment that would keep the C-130H aircraft at Fort Bragg. Now, you say that's going to save $300 million. How does that happen?
Well, there's what it's doing is putting to use $300 million that may otherwise be on planes in the boneyard, actually retiring planes that have been modernized or avionics have been modernized while we have older planes down at Fort Bragg training our Global Response Force in the 82nd Airborne and our Special Operations Special Forces men and women in uniform. So the goal, this program is over a $2.3 billion program, the AMP program, Avionics Modernization Program, for the C-130s. We just thought that it would make more sense to put them to use here. It's not at the expense of any other state. I think it's a better use of funding, and it also uses funding that's already been approved in the budget in terms of simulators and the support. What I also did, though, was pass an amendment in the NDAA during the committee process that gives the command on the ground the opportunity to say, we do not need the 440th to complete our training missions. The problem I have is I'm getting mixed answers from Washington and very definitive position on the command down at Fort Bragg that they don't think it's a good idea. The command is transitioning now. If the new commanders say that they don't need the support, then I'll take the pressure off. But that's not what I've heard to this point.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about. And it's kind of a little civics lesson, too, because obviously we want civilians to oversee military operations. That's why we have a Senate and they have an oversight responsibility. You said in proposing this amendment and moving it through that this stops the Air Force leadership's short-sighted and strategically flawed plan. So that would lead the question. I'm imagining I'm a general now in the Air Force saying, who's the senator from North Carolina saying I and the Air Force have a flawed strategy?
I'm saying to that that general in Washington or in the Pentagon, I'm hearing from people on the ground who's responsible for the execution of our global response mission, for the day-to-day training of the 82nd Airborne, the 18th Airborne Corps, the Special Operations Special Forces. When I have a two-star or three-star general state publicly that it's a bad decision that's going to disrupt their ability to accomplish their mission, my advice to the general in Washington is to listen to the general in Fort Bragg.
All right. You've called for deregulation in a number of areas. I want to move on a little bit to that subject. What does the federal government do now that you think would be better served in the private sector?
Well, I think that when I'm thinking about regulatory reform, I'm thinking about going back to regulations that have just accumulated over decades. I just had a discussion at the Duke Cancer Research Center trying to explain to them, think through the way that government regulates what you're trying to do for medical research. And don't necessarily assume that what we're asking you to do today to make sure that we have patient safety and all the necessary things in place, but ask yourself, is it the most efficient way to do it today? Because every dime that I can save on regulatory burdens is another dime that they can put into clinical research to produce a cure for HIV if you're a part of the new joint project out at UNC, or a cure for cancer, or more effective, less damaging treatment. So it's really with an eye towards right-sizing regulations exist for a reason, some of them. Some of them exist because they made sense at a point in time, but they stay on the books, and then they're made more complicated by new rules that are promulgated through the regulatory agencies. We just need to claw those back. We did that in North Carolina for four consecutive years. When we started, it was new. It was difficult for people to understand. They thought it was going to produce a lot of problems. Most of the regulatory reform measures that we put into place, I haven't heard a single person who opposed it at the time coming back and saying, now these are the ill effects of it, except that our economy is getting back on track and businesses are doing better than they were 4 years ago.
What are some examples?
Well, in North Carolina, it would be a number of things. It could be stormwater management. It could be, I'll give you a minor example. It's one of the first regulatory reform act, moves that I did back as a freshman in the minority. Don't apply to a greenhouse the same sort of building standards that you would apply to a Walmart. Think through the use of the building and don't have a one-size-fits-all. That particular project was up in Mecklenburg County. It would have got its largest greenhouse operator under one roof in the United States, Metro Atlanta Greenhouses. They were about to move somewhere else versus build another facility there. It was a simple two- or three-line change in the building codes that exempted that type of a building. So it's not the sexy, really attractive sort of big picture regulations that I'm talking about. It's the singles and doubles and all the blocking and tackling that we need to do to make the regulations more rational, easier to comply with, and easier to implement.
We'll talk more about that process and other issues as my conversation with U.S. Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, the junior U.S. Senator, serving his first term in office. We're talking about regulation before the break. One area that you have focused on is agriculture, and you say that, for instance, government shouldn't be regulating school lunches. I mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you go out and speak with, as I have, I did a farm tour and then the tour of an elementary school a couple of weeks ago. And this was after I had heard from numerous people in the school system saying that there's a tremendous amount of waste in the current school nutrition programs. You know, we have agriculture very much wanting to get involved. They want to provide food, good, healthy food from the farm to the school. But the way that they're implementing it is so prescriptive that I think what we're seeing are a lot of kids. I served on a line. I was there serving, and they had pizza. Now, all the kids like pizza, right? Until you get this pizza, which has a whole grain requirement that has a textural problem, that most of the kids take that piece of pizza, they take one bite, and they dump the rest in the trash can. I went along the line, and after they got rid of the recycling, the barrel was nearly half full of uneaten pizza. So it's more a matter of saying, why do we have a school nutrition program? Because we want to produce better health outcomes. Why can't we have a nutrition program in Washington that says we're going to measure outcomes and we're only going to intervene when the outcomes are not trending in the direction we want, but give the schools more flexibility to figure out what works for these kids? At different stages of development, kids need different kinds of foods. Highly active kids may be allowed to have more calorie intake than children who are not active, but give the schools and the school systems. In fact, in North Carolina, I've asked the school systems, and many of them, the majority of them, will pass resolutions saying we need to look at this and give us more control over the process.
Yeah, but there are also a lot, there are competing pressures. I mean, imagining a school district now under, they've had their budget cut a couple of times, and so now there's a lot of financial pressure on that school district. Multinational firms that are serving lots of high calorie and low nutrition options. I got to do that. They cut my budget and I'm stuck with the soybean oil.
Well, the irony of it now is the school nutrition program has put what had been highly successful school districts underwater. Time after time, I'm hearing, and you could go out to Western North Carolina. I met with someone who'd said she'd had a highly successful food program for years, and now they're in the red. I believe that you can capture and identify problems if you measure outcomes, if we find a way to measure the health outcomes for the children in a very meaningful way, then we can identify those who may be cutting corners. But why? I don't believe that that's the majority. I believe most of the people responsible for school nutrition want these children to be healthy, want them to eat the most healthy things that they can put in their mouths. So I trust them to make the right decision most of the time. If instead of having these burdensome and highly prescriptive regulations, we free up our resources to find the hotspots, the areas where there's problems, that's where we intervene. but then leave the majority to produce the outcomes that are better for the kids involved. There's right now very little data that suggests that there's been a sea change in health outcomes. That's what I want to see. So I think being flexible with policy alternatives are really what I'm asking for on the school nutrition program.
The regulations that are in place, and I just want to stay with this just as a sort of an object lesson for a moment, so we'll stay with it, just school nutrition. Are there outcomes related to, in other words, are obviously the federal government has its standards, they're imposed, and you talked about some of the difficulties. If you're making food nobody's going to eat, that's not highly nutritious either. On the other hand, do we require outcomes? Are we looking at whether or not these regulations work?
No, we're not. That's the thing that's remarkable to me about regulations in general in Washington. We get regulations that seem to work in theory, and we very seldom go back to see if they're actually working in practice. And that's why in every committee meeting that I'm in, when we're talking about some other program, I ask, what sort of baseline metrics did you have pre-regulation, post-regulation? How are you able to track trends to have it serve as any basis for making adjustments over time? But we go through these once-and-done regulatory phases with very little backward reference to, are we actually doing the things that we want done with the program, like improving kids' health?
Now, well, you're talking about regulations, and of course, there's a whole other arena when it comes to regulating the behavior of Americans. As you know, the North Carolina General Assembly recently approved a longer waiting period for women who are seeking abortions. On social issues, where do you draw the line on when and where the federal government should impose regulations on legally authorized procedures like abortion?
Well, I think it varies from subject matter to subject matter. On the life issue, I'm pro-life, and I'm Catholic, and I'm pro-life, and I try to do everything I can to strike the balance between respecting a woman's reproductive rights and recognizing that at some point in time that is a living being that I also have an obligation to protect. So on that issue, there's always going to be that struggle about how to get it right. On other issues, I've made it very clear that the federal government, particularly on the issues that you may be talking about, there are things that are best left to the states. Respect the decisions of states, whether or not you agree with them. We've had this discussion on same-sex marriage. I think that the states should be allowed to make decisions, and I don't believe the federal government should intervene. And I think that in a state like North Carolina, where a purple state, where we're a centrist state on any given issue, people will either be right or left of center, that's a particularly challenging balance that the leadership and the legislature have to face. But it's their job to do that.
Well, you mentioned being a Catholic. We know where the Pope stands on abortion, but the Supreme Court has said that it is a legally authorized procedure. So should even the states be allowed to restrict what the law of the land says is the right of everyone in this country?
Well, I think what you get into is the discussion about the restriction and arguments about whether or not you have the health and the hygiene and best information available for an expectant mother to make a decision. That's really the basis of the discussion, rather than what some have said are outright restrictions. That was said back when there was some discussions about improving the standards for healthcare clinics. People 3-4 years ago said all the clinics would be closed within 12 months. They're all open. In fact, the Department of Health has taken a very prudent approach towards determining whether or not, if any, of the health standards should be improved. So, you know, the problem with these issues, Frank, is people want to polarize the electorate very quickly versus look at the essence of the issue. Can we do things that provide better informed choices, ensure the health and safety of the patient, ensure the health and safety of the child?
Yeah, but there's a kind of a theory behind some of this, too. I mean, you talked about the idea that local school districts might be the best place to figure out what's best for their kids. States have a better perspective on what's happening in their state than the federal government. So when it comes to information about abortion, isn't the woman the one who knows how much time I need to make the decision?
Well, I think that you have to determine whether or not the information's been made available to them. That's, again, the essence of the issue. Are we certain that all the alternatives that a young person, and many of them are very young, not all, have access to that information? And when you consider the upbringing of a disproportionate number of expectant mothers who may be considering such a procedure, then I think you want to make sure that they're making a profound decision. You want to provide the best information to make it available to them. And quite honestly, I think that either side of the equation could only want to limit the information to something that in some cases supports a political agenda as much as the best outcome for the expectant mother.
Well, and that gets back to whether the regulation is tested for the outcome. I mean, if just by expanding the waiting period, we still haven't guaranteed that you've gotten any better information in that 3 days, right? There's no way of knowing. There's no way of knowing whether or not you're better informed at the end.
Well, I think that you can measure at least some outcomes in terms of other options that are pursued. It depends on. I think everything has to come up with a reasonable basis for measurement. But at least in the case of some of the legislation that has passed, it has resulted in some expectant mothers choosing a different course. Now the question is. I guess they would be best to be left to ask the question, why did you make that decision? Why did you make a decision that, statistically speaking, hadn't been made prior to the implementation of new legislation?
I want to take a look at something else that's just popped up recently, although we're seeing more and more of it. But just this month, New York Times CBS News poll did a poll about income inequality. And it showed that 61% of Americans believe that just a few people at the top have a chance to get ahead. That's a huge difference from just 15 years ago that showed the reverse. 72% felt that opportunities were available for advancement. And there are a number of metrics in this poll. We can go over all of them if you want, that really show a loss of faith in the what we would call the American dream. That is, with hard work, anybody can make it. A real reversal in that. And I wonder what you make of that.
I think it's one of the saddest subjects that I have to talk about. I'm not sure how old you are, but I'm 54 years old. And
I'm older than you.
And to have thought when I was that 19-year-old kid out on my own, I left home when I was 17 after I graduated, it never occurred to me that I didn't have great opportunities. Had to work my way through school. It took me 18 years to do it. But all along the way, there was always a sense that I was going to be able to realize my dreams. And I think it's a sad statement on our country that we have a majority of people, parents, who believe that their children are not going to be as well off as they are, and young people having the demoralizing notion that they somehow, no matter whether they work hard or not, they can't succeed. There's something in the American psyche that needs to change when it starts approaching those numbers in the polls.
What about the distribution? I mean, that I think is one of the more interesting features of this poll. Do you feel the distribution of money and wealth in this country is fair, or do you think the money and wealth should be more evenly distributed? And there you get 66% of the population that says it's unfair.
I think that the opportunities need to be more evenly distributed. You know, you have some people that believe that those who have made it owe it to those who haven't to have their wealth redistributed. The problem with that, over time, you run out of other people's money. I think that what we're talking about are education opportunities, job opportunities, that I believe have been stifled as a result of economic policies. A lot of what we have here and why there seems to be an income equality gap have to do with fewer opportunities for people to get the kinds of jobs that I had the opportunity to get when I was growing up. So I think that if you purely go about this income inequality problem by trying to narrow the gap, by redistributing money that someone have made to people who need money, I don't think that it's a sustainable strategy. There are some fundamental economic changes that we need to make to get economic growth where we need to be. If we were, we would not be having this discussion, I'm completely convinced, and the polls would not be yielding that kind of data if we were at a sustainable 4% GDP growth versus an anemic 1% or 2%. So I think if we focus on getting the economy back on track, if we focus on consistent economic recovery, increasing trade, doing the kinds of things that we can do to grow a thriving energy sector, then those polls will change because the opportunities will be there. Then what we need to do is find out of those that for whatever reason, even with those increased opportunities, they can't seem to get where they need to be economically. Let's solve that problem, which would be far smaller than the problem we have today.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that because GDP growth had for a long time, particularly in the post-World War II era, been pretty closely linked to real wage growth. And then it broke. That linkage broke in the 1980s. And beyond, we saw GDP continue to grow at pretty steady rates with a couple of interruptions along the way. And yet wages went flat and at times actually fell behind. So with wages not keeping pace with GDP growth, could that be the reason that people feel like they're not really participating in this growth that we see elsewhere and certainly on Wall Street?
I think that may be a part of it. But also, if you recall back in the 2000s, very few of these conversations were being had. Everybody was excited. Now, I think to Greenspan's credit, there was a certain amount of irrational exuberance involved. We were probably more excited than we should have been. But I believe that when you create jobs, you create more demand for jobs, high-skilled jobs, labor, technically skilled jobs, you will create that increased pressure on wages. And we just simply don't have it right now.
But again, that hasn't happened either. The Triangle Business Journal just took a look statewide at the increase in jobs, job creation in North Carolina. It was pretty good numbers. And then they took a look at where the increases took place, and they were mostly low-wage jobs. And so again, you can increase the number of jobs, but if the wealth doesn't follow and if the wages have not followed, it really hasn't happened yet.
Well, I agree. And I think that, there are, in North Carolina, there have been bright spots. If you take a look at what we're seeing in the high-tech sector and right around here in Research Triangle and biotech sector, financial services sector, we're seeing some improvement, but not near enough. But quite honestly, some of the ways you're going to get a broader base of high-paying jobs, not necessarily the high six-figure jobs, but five-figure jobs, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 jobs, is to recognize that we have to get our tax and our regulatory environment in place and energy prices maintained at levels today so that we can start creating those manufacturing jobs and technically skilled jobs that we simply don't have. You can't build that broad base that will raise the average wages across the spectrum of skill sets without having some alternative to the manufacturing jobs that we had back in the 80s and before.
You think we should increase the minimum wage?
I think that that's a decision that the state should make. If North Carolina and the legislature decided that that's something that made sense for North Carolina, I wouldn't object to it. But I don't think that it makes sense for the federal government to set a policy that's a national policy. I think it's something that should be left to the states.
This actually, frankly, surprised me in the poll that 71% of those asked did think the minimum wage should be raised to $10.10. I mean, it's 71%. That figure surprised me. I don't know if it's surprising.
You know, I really have not taken the time to look at the crosstabs on those polls, but I always wonder if they put it in the right context. Would you support the minimum wage if you knew X? That's your potential prices for a given category would go up, or why that certain jobs would be lost because certain employers may not be able to absorb the minimum wage without reducing jobs. So I always wonder whether or not, of course, when you ask the question, do you think the minimum wage should go up, that the average person is going to say yes, because they're sympathetic. If they're like me, they worked for minimum wage before, they're sympathetic to minimum wage earners, they would like for it to go up. But we have to weigh that against the consequences of it and potential job losses and whether or not it really nets a significant benefit. One of the advantages to seeing what they've done in Los Angeles and some other cities and raising the minimum wage, we'll be able to see with these laboratories. That's why I say go back to the state. With these laboratories out there of democracy, let's see how well they do over time.
Well, I mean, I think that's the argument for a federal minimum wage. If you're an enclave that's surrounded by lower wages all around you, that experiment is somewhat flawed in the sense that there wasn't, you know, the kind of ecosystem, the environment that you're working
but
in.
But you're working, but that. We need to understand if we could set a global minimum wage, maybe we could have that argument, but we don't compete in a purely domestic world here. So, I mean, the same argument you could use for a federal minimum wage, you could say maybe you need a global minimum wage so everybody goes up. That's the whole problem with it. That's why I think you have to look at areas that think that they can manage a wage increase and see if they actually can. See if they gain economic activity, if they don't lose any jobs, if all they got out of it was a higher standard of living. But I think there are many people and many economists who don't believe that we'll get. It's not a net gain. There are winners and losers when you do it, and I'd like to see that through the data.
You talked about the impact of the global economy, and of course the market will say, I can get this done cheaper elsewhere, and so that's where the dollars flow, and we understand that's how the market works. There are also people who say there's a better wage somewhere else and better conditions, and they move into this country. That's the market saying, and they work here. Immigration policy. There are millions of people who are currently working in this country
legally,
and there are many who are here illegally. Mm-hmm. What should we do about that?
Well, I think we need to start by fixing. I've spent the last several weeks working on a problem with H-2B visas that are largely non-agriculture work visas. And we've finally gotten the Department of Homeland Security to free up and potentially grant additional visas because we think that they fell short of what they should have. And it was threatening, in our particular case, the seafood processing industry out along the coast. I think one of the things we can do is get the legal immigration policy right to provide a consistent, predictable way for someone to apply to come work legally in this country. But they're not working well. The H-1 program, the H-2 program, we have a number of things that are not working. And quite honestly, I think if we did it right, we would have people want to come here legally, go back home, and come back. That has the added benefit of reducing the pressure on people who come here illegally, reducing pressure on the border. And I might add that for those who think that these visa programs are at the expense of American workers, I don't buy that. I actually think the failure to provide this legal immigration to fill certain jobs will kill jobs, as they would have killed jobs down along the coast if we haven't succeeded in getting these H-2B visas to workers who are willing to do that work. These businesses are not able to find American workers to fill certain jobs.
So they'll go overseas.
That's exactly right. And these jobs, if they're not filled, will be at the expense of the commercial fishermen and a lot of other people involved in the supply chain and the seafood industry.
Senator, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Senator Tom Tillis, Jr., United States Senator from North Carolina, a Republican and a guest on The State of Things. Just ahead, a new collection of short stories from creative writing professor Pam Durbin. Please stay tuned.